Bon, alors on va pouvoir reprendre la partie séminaire de cette séance. Je voudrais d'abord m'excuser auprès d'une partie de l'audience parce que j'ai appris que certains n'avaient pas vu que les cours avaient été déplacés à 10h et qu'il y a des gens qui sont arrivés à 9h30 apparemment, donc je suis vraiment tout à fait désolé de ça. C'est vrai que ça a été changé sur le site web il y a un peu plus d'un mois, mais seulement un mois, et que c'est 9h30 sur l'affiche écrite. La raison pour laquelle on a décalé à 10h, ce n'est pas uniquement le fait que j'ai du mal à me lever tôt, c'est aussi et surtout le fait qu'il y a quand même pas mal de gens qui viennent du plateau de Saclay pour assister à ces cours, surtout étant donné ce domaine, et c'est un peu mieux de prendre le RERB à 9h qu'à 8h30. Donc c'est la raison principale, et donc je confirme que le début des séances sera toujours 10h. Voilà, donc c'est pas la peine de venir à 9h30, sauf si vous voulez profiter des fauteuils. La deuxième chose, c'est que, comme vous l'avez remarqué, j'ai doctement expliqué que la densité de porteurs était de l'ordre de 10 puissance 14 dans ces systèmes, et que dans le dernier transparent, il y avait marqué 10 puissance 24. C'est une typo, le 2 est un 1. Il s'agit bien de 10 puissance 14, d'accord? Sinon, on serait en train de donner une conférence de presse. Voilà, alors donc, aujourd'hui, comme je l'ai dit à plusieurs reprises, on a le plaisir d'accueillir Jean-Marc Triscon, qui est professeur à l'université de Genève et également vice-recteur de cette université. J'ai découvert en regardant à nouveau sa biographie qu'on avait soutenu notre thèse pratiquement la même année. Donc Jean-Marc a fait sa thèse en 87 avec Øystein Fischer, le regretté Øystein Fischer, qui a fait tellement pour la matière condensée en Suisse. Il a travaillé sur de très nombreux sujets, en particulier les ferroélectriques, sur lesquels il a fait des très très beaux travaux. Toute cette physique, au début les cuprates supraconducteurs, bien sûr, les ferroélectriques, puis toute cette physique des interfaces d'oxyde, et il est en particulier l'un des découvreurs de la supraconductivité dans le liquide électronique à l'interface LAOSTO, qui est donc le principal sujet, je pense, de son séminaire d'aujourd'hui. Voilà, il est fellow de l'American Physical Society. Il a reçu en 2014, comme je vous l'ai montré tout à l'heure, le prix Europhysics Condensed Matter pour ses travaux pionniers dans ce domaine des hétérostructures d'oxyde. Et je ne vais pas dire beaucoup plus de choses sur Jean-Marc et simplement lui laisser la parole.
Merci beaucoup Antoine pour cette présentation et puis merci pour l'invitation. C'est un plaisir pour moi d'être ici et d'avoir le plaisir de partager certains de nos intérêts à Genève. Je précise juste une chose, vice-recteur seulement à 50%. C'est ce qui me permet de continuer mes travaux de recherche, donc c'est important. Peut-être aussi il va y avoir un léger recouvrement entre les deux présentations, mais je pense que ce n'est pas très grave et puis je crois que c'est important pour... la logique. Et puis, on m'a demandé de faire la présentation en anglais, donc je vais passer en anglais pour la suite. Et donc, j'aimerais commencer. I would like to start by explaining why we're interested in these oxide heterostructures. And to do so, I was thinking that it may be good to go back to silicon. Silicon is everywhere, you know, electronics, and in all our computers, cell phones. And it's interesting to follow the history of the transistor. And I guess you all know that the transistor was discovered in 1947. And you see here a picture of the pioneers at Bell Labs. And when you look at the history of the transistor, you realize that it's a very impressive progress. But it's also quite interesting to look at the time scale and the time which was necessary to bring this technology to efficient devices. And you see here this history, 1947 discovery. In 71, you have this Intel chip with 2,300 transistors, and in 93, 3 millions, 40 millions, 1.7 billions in 2007. And there is this really fantastic number that you see here. In 2014, 2.5 10 to the 20 transistors were fabricated. 250 billion of billions, or 100 million a day per human being on the planet. This is really an amazing number. And so when you think about silicon, and if you maybe ask someone in the street, he may think that silicon is somehow a magic material, a very sophisticated compound, a material with a lot of functionalities because it's so useful. But in fact, it's not. We know it's a simple electron system, which is described by single particle physics. So you need something, you need to add something to silicon to give silicon its functionality. And what you have to add is an interface. And for instance, a very famous interface between silicon and silicon dioxide, which is at the heart of the field effect transistor. Today it's more an hafnium oxide gate dielectric, which is used. And this is indeed why, as mentioned by Antoine, Herbert Kromer mentioned in his Nobel lecture that the interface is the device. Now, although there is a fantastic success with silicon and transistors, there are issues. And one of the issues that we are facing today is dissipation. It's a very serious problem, and this is why computer farms are now often located north of the planet to benefit from natural cooling. You see a computer farm in Sweden. And so it might be a good idea to try looking at other materials, other family of compounds, materials which by themselves are more sophisticated or maybe display more functionalities. And I guess this is why we're looking at other families of compounds. And some people look at graphene, for instance. Some people look at chalcogenides or decalcogenides and see what can be done with these materials. On our side, and as mentioned by Antoine in his lecture, we are more interested in oxides. And so I will talk during this presentation about perovskites with this structure that you've already seen, and the simple ABO3 formula, A and B being cations, and you see on the structure that the A cation is here in the corner of a cube, a B cation in the middle, and you have this oxygen octahedra. So the perovskite is a calcium titanate structure, and in fact, it's a very common structure on Earth. So what I would like to do now is start with oxides, go to oxide structure, oxide interfaces, and maybe end up explaining why we're interested in this rather new field, which is called oxide interface physics. And to do so, let me first mention the system which launched this field of research. And this system is an interface, which was mentioned by Antoine, the interface between two perovskites, between strontium titanate and lanthanum aluminate, two insulating perovskites. We are talking about band insulators. And what was found in 2004 is that if you start with strontium titanate in the O1 direction, with a TiO2 termination, and you grow on this strontium titanate an epitaxial layer of lanthanum aluminate, so another good band insulator, you find at the interface a conducting layer. And as you see here, you see the sheet resistance versus temperature, you see that this the mobility of this conducting layer at low temperature is quite high. And you see here one of these interfaces, so the sample is completely transparent, the only thing you see are contacts which are used to connect to this electron system. And the stunning discovery of Akira Otomo and Harold Wong generated a lot of interest and a lot of further work. And you see in the back of the slide a very partial list of papers which have been published in Physical Review and Nature and magazine and science magazines. So a lot of interest because people were trying to understand why is this interface conducting, but also because we have now mobile electrons in a complex oxide. And so one can hope to find interesting properties. And as mentioned in 2007, in collaboration with the group of Johan Mannert, we found in Geneva that the system is in fact superconducting at low temperature. You see here the sheet resistance versus temperature, and you see the transition around 300 millikelvin, and I will discuss superconductivity in more detail. And a little later, through a series of work, their system also displayed signatures of magnetism. And as you will see, the system is indeed displaying quite fascinating properties. Now, at the end of 2007, Science magazine considered these results as one of the breakthroughs of the year and raised this question beyond silicon. Again, this question, is it possible that with this system or with oxide interfaces, can we go beyond what is possible today with silicon? And maybe I'll try to come back to this question at the end of the presentation. So what I would like to do during this talk, I would like first generally go back very quickly, because Antoine covered this partly in his lecture, go back to this question, why oxide heterostructures and interfaces? Then I'll focus on the lanthanum aluminate strontium titanate system, or LAOSTO system. I'll briefly mention the origin of the conductivity. Antoine covered this. I'll just add a couple of information. And then I'll show you something which is very special to the system, which is the fact that several of the electronic properties can be controlled with an electric field effect, like in a field effect transistor, and this is rather unique. Then I'll turn to superconductivity, and I'll mention a few open issues, and I'll end by mentioning some developments, some recent developments. Okay, so why are we interested in these oxides? I think oxides display a variety of properties, and that was mentioned. They can be insulating or conducting, depending on the choice you make for the AB cations. But unlike silicon, they display many instabilities. And some of these instabilities are structural instabilities, like anti-ferro distortions, like rotation of oxygen octahedra, like in calcium titanate or strontium titanate. You have polar instabilities, which lead to ferroelectricity, for instance, in barium titanate or lead titanate. But you have also electronic instabilities, which can lead to orbital ordering, magnetism, or superconductivity. And what is amazing in this family of compounds is that all these properties are found in the same perovskite structure and often with very similar lattice parameters between the different compounds. As mentioned by Antoine, many of these systems are characterized by strong electronic correlations and complex phase diagrams. You see here the one of the manganites and of the cuprates. And again, what is important here is that these different phases show that the system has difficulties in choosing its ground state. Probably you have different states very close in energy. And this is why these materials are sensitive to external parameters like pressure or maybe magnetic field. This is also why people think these materials can be very good sensors, because eventually you can get a strong response for a small stimulus. As I said, all these properties are found in perovskites with rather a similar lattice parameters. So it's a little bit like Lego bricks. And because they are very similar and very similar in size, often you're able to stack them in structures, and that was mentioned, and I will not spend time here. And there are different techniques which allow us today to produce very perfect structure, and you see again this picture here. Now, I just said that these materials are sensitive to external parameters, to perturbations, but if you think about it, an interface is a major perturbation because you've changed half of the neighbor. So the idea behind this field of oxide interface physics is that at oxide interfaces, because of this fundamental symmetry breaking that you have, possible strain gradients, charge transfer, frustration, or maybe electrostatic coupling, you may, at the interface, modify the properties, maybe play on these different degrees of freedom, charge, orbital spin, lattice, and eventually generate new phases or new properties. And I think this is the dream of this field of research, which is to discover at oxide interfaces new phases or possibly new functionalities. And there are different systems which have been investigated. Myself, I will focus now on the lanthanum aluminate strontium titanate interface. Okay, before to go on, let me mention the people who did the work in Geneva. the Geneva team today, Stefano Garrillo, who is a senior scientist in the group and who is very, very involved in this research, Margherita Boselli, Adrien Velschi, their PhD students, Ritsuko Eguchi, she's an assistant professor in Japan, and she's visiting for a year. And I would like also to mention important former members, Andrea Caviglia, who is now an assistant professor in Delft, Nicola Rehren, who is here in Paris, in CNRS, Claudia Cancelleri, she's at EMPA, close to Zurich, Daniela Stornaiolo, she's now in Naples, Zhenping Wu was visiting from Beijing, he's an assistant professor, he's back in Beijing today, and Denver Lee just finished his PhD, he's now at Stanford University. And there are many collaborations, I cannot mention all of them, but let me mention a very important collaboration with Marc Gabet, Marc who is here, and Manali Vivek and his group, Philippe Gosset in Liège, Jorn Mannart in Stuttgart, Odile Stefan, Alex Clotter, who are here today, and their groups, and it's a great pleasure to have this opportunity to work on this fascinating system with them. Okay, so let me now focus on the LAO-STO system. Just one word on the preparation of these interfaces. We use pulse laser deposition. So we start with a single crystal of strontium titanate, TiO2 terminated. You go to a temperature of maybe 800 degrees C. And then you grow epitaxially a layer of lanthanum aluminate of only a few unit cells. And after the growth, you can check either by TEM, that the quality of the layer is good. You can look at X-ray diffraction to check that the thickness is the one you were expecting. We also use this reed that Antoine mentioned. And you can also look at the surface of your films, which shows a step and terrace surface. This is just mimicking the structure of the starting substrate. So now let me move and discuss first why is this interface conducting. Okay, I think it's been explained by Antoine. I think the main thing and the reason why we believe this interface is conducting is this polar discontinuity, which was explained. So in strontium titanate, in this O1 direction, you alternate neutral planes, but when you move to lanthanum aluminate, you have these charged planes. So you have this electric field between these, you can see this as an infinite capacitor, you have this electric field and you have a diverging potential. And as explained, this polar catastrophe scenario needs to be fixed. And one way to do this is to transfer charge from the surface to the interface. And the transfer is half a unit cell. These charges go to the titanium 3D band. And the charge density is 310 to the 14 per square centimeter. Now, if you do this, you cancel this divergence and you see this potential is now oscillating. Now, other scenarios have been discussed a lot. For instance, the possibility that lanthanum strontium intermixing is taking place, and we know that there is, to some degree, lanthanum strontium intermixing. Oxygen vacancies in strontium titanate are also known to bring conductivity. Maybe one thing to say is that this mechanism can introduce charges in the system and introduce conductivity, but they're not really solving the polar catastrophe problem. So let me be a bit more precise with this problem and maybe show you one experiment which seems to suggest that indeed this polar discontinuity is playing an important role. So this is a band structure at the interface. You see strontium titanate with a 3.2 eV gap, lanthanum aluminate 5.6 eV. Now you have an electric field in lanthanum aluminate, so you have band bending. And with the lanthanum aluminate thickness, the top of the LAO valence band is going up in energy. And what you see, at some thickness, you reach the bottom of the STO conduction band. And at this critical thickness, you have a zener breakdown, and you transfer charges from the valence band of LAO to STO. Now, this critical thickness can be calculated because we know the electric field in lanthanum aluminate. It's simply the surface charge divided by the dielectric constant. We know this distance in energy, And so, it's a one-line calculation to calculate this critical thickness. And if you do the calculation, you find 3.5 unit cells. So there is a very clear prediction. If you grow below 4 unit cells of lanthanum aluminate, the interface should be insulating. If you grow 4 or more, it should be conducting. And in fact, this was found first in the group of Jochen Mannhardt at the time in Augsburg by Stefan Thiel and collaborators. And you see here the conductance versus LAO thickness. And you see 1, 2, 3 unit cell, it's insulating. 4, it's conducting. And you see also data from Geneva. And this is a very robust result, which has been reproduced in many groups. And there are other experiments which are pointing towards the key role of the polar discontinuity, but there has been a lot of discussion on the subject, but I don't want to discuss this more. Maybe one thing I should add is that today, or these days, there is another model which is discussed a lot, the idea that oxygen vacancies, but not in strontium titanate, but oxygen vacancies at the surface of LAO could be at the origin of the electron system. And the idea is quite simple. If you form oxygen vacancies at the LAO surface, each oxygen vacancy is freeing 2 electrons, and these 2 electrons can be transferred to the interface. And calculations by different people like Nick Bristov, Yu and Zunger, or Zhu and collaborators, all these calculations suggest that the formation energy for this vacancy is going to zero precisely at 4 unit cells. So this or these models are also predicting a critical thickness of 4 unit cells. And I will not go in the detail, but it might well be that this mechanism is a good one. Okay, let me move on and now discuss something which is very important, which is the doping control in the system and electric field effect experiments. So the electrons in this interfacial system are naturally sandwiched between lanthanum aluminate and strontium titanate. And so two good insulators. So very quickly, the idea came to use an electric field to change or to tune the carrier density and to study the effect of this change on the electronic properties. Now, if you look at the density of mobile electrons, we find that it's typically 2 to 8, 10 to the 13 per square centimeter, depending on the sample. So less than what is predicted by the polar catastrophe scenario. Mobility is 100 to 1,000 centimeters square per volt second at low T. Now, if you think about these densities, these 2D densities, it's very low. If you take a top view, it's maybe 1 electrons every 25 unit cells. And to perform field effect experiments, different geometries have been used. For instance, you can use a back gate. So you use your strontium titanate single crystal as a gate dielectric. That's a thick gate dielectric. You can put a gate on top of lanthanum aluminate, or you can even use side gates, like here. And you see an example of the tuning of the conductance as a function of the gate voltage. So it's a very efficient way to tune the conductivity and the carrier density. Now, the most spectacular effect of this tuning is on superconductivity. So let me show you this. This is now the sheet resistance, log scale, temperature, and you see here superconducting transition. This is a sample with a back gate. And what we will do, we will increase negative VG, so back gate, and we slowly reduce the amount of electrons at the interface. So if you do this, first, you see, okay, the resistance, the sheet resistance is going up because you reduce electrons, but maybe TC is going up a little bit. Now you continue and you start to see that TC is going down, TC is going down. Finally, the system is in a weakly insulating state. And now what you see here is that between these two curves, you have some kind of a superconducting switch. So an electric field at low temperature allows you to go back and forth between a superconducting state and a resistive state. And still today, this is the only system which allows at low temperature this switching between this reversible switching between a superconducting state and a resistive state. We also used this is an experiment realized with a group of Jochen Mannhardt. We use a top gate here, and you see that 1.5 volts also allows this switching. Now you can measure many curves. You see here one example where you see the sheet resistance, log scale, temperature, linear scale. And you see that when you are in the insulating state quotation mark, it's a weakly insulating state. You see that superconductivity appears at some doping. TC is going up, and finally TC is going down. Now, with these curves, you can use a TC criterion, and you can draw the phase diagram of the system. And this is the phase diagram with here a Costelli-Stahulez criterion. You see this a superconducting pocket. I'll explain why it's a 2D superconductor later. And you see this underdope regime, maximum TC, and this overdope regime. And I'll come back to this phase diagram a little later, and I'll try to compare this phase diagram to bulk superconductivity that you find in strontium titanate. But before to do this, let me discuss quantum confinement and the electronic structure of the system. So the question here is, we have this conducting layer and superconducting layer at the interface, and the question is, what is the extension of this conducting layer? And different experiments have been performed. I'm going here quite quickly. In Paris here, in the group of Agnès Barthélemy and Manuel Bibes, they use cross-section. You see a cross-section, lanthanum aluminate, strontium titanate. And they measure directly the conductance using an AFM tip, which is conducting and which allows the surface to be scanned. They could see the conduction here at room temperature and at low T. In Fribourg, they use optical spectroscopy and also studied an optical mode, which is confined by the finite width of this conducting channel. In Geneva, here, we use parallel and perpendicular critical fields to extract the thickness of the superconducting layer, which is, by the way, much smaller than the current length, and this is why the system is 2D. And all these experiments kind of agree to say that the width of this conducting layer at low T is maybe 10 to 12 nanometer. Now, there are consequences. This confinement is modifying the electronic structure. Let me explain this very rapidly. Or electrons are the in the titanium 3D band. And now if you think about the 3D band, you have T2G and EG orbitals, which in principle are degenerate. You see the T2G orbital, XY, YZ, XZ, the EG, X square minus Y square, 3Z square minus R square. But now if you are in a perovskite structure, you realize that the T2G orbitals are pointing away from the negatively charged oxygen. And though their energy is lower than the EG, which are pointing towards the negatively charged oxygen ions. And so this is why you have this crystal field splitting, and the EG are much higher in energy. So our electrons will be in the T2G orbitals. Now, what these T2G orbitals, in principle, if STO is cubic, are degenerate. But now, at the interface, and this was first found by Marco Saluzzo and co-workers, they found that the XY orbitals, and XY orbitals are the ones running along the interface, are lower in energy than the XZYZ that you see here. So there is a splitting, and this is confirmed by electronic structure calculations. You see the one of Delugas and co-workers. You see that the system now is forming subbands because you have something like a quantum well. So you see that you have different light XY orbitals. And finally here you see the YZ orbitals, heavier subbands. Now if you look at the extension of these subbands, you see this here. This may be a bit complicated, but what you see is this is lanthanum aluminate, this is strontium titanate, this is energy, and what you see here is the probability to find electrons. So if you take the lowest energy subband, light one, you see that it's very localized here at the interface. Now, when you move up in energy, you see that these subbands go deeper and deeper into strontium titanate, and you see the XZYZ naturally go further in the substrate. You notice also that the probability to find electrons is really on titanium. So it's quite different from a 3-5 electron gas. And this is why we like to call this system a 2D electron liquid and not a 2D electron gas. Now, with our gate, what we do, we're changing the level of the chemical potential. And for instance, we can lower the chemical potential, and eventually we can be in a regime here where we have only light bands. So do we see this in transport? We do. And for instance, you see if you measure the Hall effect versus magnetic field, Rxy, you can see that you go from a linear regime at low doping, so a single band, to a nonlinear regime. And you can quantify this level of nonlinearity. You see also, I will not go into detail, but you see also oscillations when you're in plane and you rotate the magnetic field. And these oscillations, we believe, are linked to this heavy anisotropic bands. So we have ways to determine at which doping level, or at which VG, if you want, we start filling the heavy band. And now, depending on the experiment and the sensitivity of the experiments, this filling is somewhere here in this region. Okay, let me now go back to superconductivity, and what I would like to do is to compare bulk and interfacial superconductivity. So I guess many of you know that strontium titanate itself in bulk can be doped and is superconducting. So you can replace strontium by lanthanum, titanium by niobium, or you can reduce the oxygen content. And if you do this and you measure TC versus carrier density, now it's a 3D carrier density, you find that TC is going up and TC is going down. And TC is about, maximum TC is about 0.3K. So it looks rather similar to the interface. And this is why it's interesting to compare in detail this behavior with the one we find at the interface. I should mention here, I have no time to go into detail, but there is a beautiful experiments coming from the group of Cameron Benya, who has been looking at this problem and extending the phase diagram at lower doping and also showing that there are some structures which are linked to different bands. Okay, for the purpose of this talk, we can take a simplified bulk phase diagram. So this is TC versus doping against 3D carrier density. And now to compare, we have to map our 2D system on the 3D one. And in fact, in principle, it's quite easy. You just divide N2D by the width of this superconducting layer, maybe keeping in mind that it's not a uniform carrier density. The carrier density is decaying as you move away from the interface, but we can take this as a first approximation. So if you take a standard sample, maybe it's 3.10 to the 13 carriers per square centimeter, 10 nanometer, if you divide, you find that the 3D density is somewhere here. And the surprise we have is that we know that our field effect is very efficient to tune superconductivity, but when you look or you measure the amount of charge you remove or you add, it's not very much. We're changing only maybe by a factor of 2 or 3. And so the area we explore, or let's say the doping range we explore, is very small. So I will not go in here in all the details, but I would like just to explain why superconductivity appears much later in the system than in the bulk. And one of the ideas is that this is due to this modified electronic structure. This is the bulk electronic structure. This is coming from a paper from Dirk van der Maal and co-workers. And in the bulk, very rapidly, when you start filling, you have a heavy band. And a heavy band means a high density of states, and superconductivity likes high density of state. Now, at the interface, because of the confinement, we've pushed the heavy band at higher doping. This is what I discussed just before. So what we have to do at the interface is to fill all these light bands before to touch this one. And we know that superconductivity appears in a doping range which is close to the one where we start filling these bands. And this could be the explanation why superconductivity appears at higher doping. Okay, so let me now move on. And what I would like to do is to discuss with you some open questions on superconductivity. The first one is superconductivity itself in strontium titanate. I would like to spend some time to discuss this with you. Then I would like to mention the possible role of spin orbit. I didn't discuss yet spin orbit, but I will introduce spin orbit and explain why it can be important for superconductivity. And then I will end up with questions which are also open on the underdoped regime in this system. So let's start by superconductivity in strontium titanate. So strontium titanate is a quantum paraelectric. And you see this if you measure the dielectric response. This is the dielectric constant as a function of temperature from a paper of Karl Alex Müller and Burkhardt. And you see that the dielectric constant is diverging when you go to low T, like in a ferroelectric material, but eventually it saturates. So the system is trying to become ferroelectric, but never makes it. So if you think about it, what it means that if you look here at energy versus polarization, if you have a paraelectric or dielectric, the energy is minimum for zero polarization. If you have a ferroelectric, you have a double well, and the polarization is stable for a given value of the polarization in one direction or the other one. Now, a quantum paraelectric is a system where you have a very shallow double well, which allows, at low temperature, quantum tunneling between these two wells. So the system is close to the ferroelectric state, but is not ferroelectric. And recently, in this paper, Edge and co-workers, Nicolas Baldin, Sasha Balatsky, discuss the possibility that superconductivity in strontium titanate is linked to ferroelectric fluctuations, to the proximity of the system to this ferroelectric state. And the idea is that in strontium titanate, this is our superconducting dome, the system would turn into a superconductor when the Fermi surface forms. And then superconductivity would disappear when you move too far away from quantum criticality. And in this paper, they predict that if you replace oxygen 16 by oxygen 18, strontium titanate becomes ferroelectric. This is well known. And what they predict is that if you go on this axis, oxygen 16 to oxygen 18, at some point the system is becoming ferroelectric. And this doping with oxygen 18 is a way to bring the system closer to a quantum critical point. And their prediction is that if you do this, TC should go up, all the way up to 1K, and the dome should shift on the left side. There has been recent experiments in bulk, in crystals, in the group of Dirk van der Marel by Adrien Stucki and others. And you see here the transition. This is black is oxygen 16. Red is oxygen 18. And systematically, they find a higher TC for oxygen 18. But if you look at the value, it's not really higher than the maximum TC we get for strontium titanate. And there is a very nice paper of Richau and co-workers in the group of Cameron Benya, which just appeared in Nature Physics. And with Mark Gabe, with Mark, we wrote a news and views on this paper. And there they use another way to bring strontium titanate to ferroelectricity, which is to use calcium substitution. So they introduce calcium, and if you do this, you see here this is a Curie temperature versus doping. You can also bring strontium titanate in a ferroelectric state. And again, in this paper, they discuss first the coexistence of superconductivity and ferroelectric-like state, but also they compare TC, and again, they find over some doping range that TC is higher for calcium dope strontium titanate. So the question is really open, can we boost TC with calcium dope strontium titanate? And I will show you some, yes?
So why does it change going from oxygen 16 to oxygen 18?
Why TC is going up, you mean? Okay, so
and this drives the paraelectric to.
I think the idea. The idea is that if you substitute oxygen 18 for oxygen 16, the system will become at some point ferroelectric. Okay? That's a fact. So to take strontium titanate, you replace oxygen 16 by oxygen 18, ferroelectric, strontium titanate becomes ferroelectric.
Is it kind of negative pressure? And
oh, I see. Why is it becoming ferroelectric? That's a question. Oh, okay.
Oxygen 18 is bigger, right?
Yeah, yeah. So any oxygen 18. Yeah, I think it's a very, strontium titanate is really on the verge of being ferroelectric. So if you put calcium, for instance, calcium is a little smaller, and the system turns into ferroelectric. Oxygen 18 also, you turn the system into a ferroelectric. So this has been measured by many groups. So this is not the point here. But the important thing here is that this prediction is telling you that if you do this, your system is closer to this quantum critical point, and possibly you have a higher TC. And this was the goal of these experiments. So the results are that TC, when you compare two samples, TC is higher, but still TC is still 0.3 Kelvin. So we do not go at this point. We do not get a much higher TC. So what I want just to show you now is really very preliminary experiments at the LAOS2 interface. There is no conclusion because it's really preliminary and we have no conclusive experiments. But what we did, we used also substrates, which are now calcium-doped strontium titanate substrates, which are ferroelectric. So these substrates have been measured using the electron system. And you see here this peak in the dielectric constant. This is capacitance, but this is essentially the dielectric constant, with a small surprise that we do not understand. 0.5 should have a TC which is lower than 1, so there are questions to solve. But I just want to tell you that we have started these experiments, and we have measured the, this is TC now, this is the dome, this is the TC dome you've seen before, and these are the dome with calcium 1%, 0.5%. No conclusion at the moment, but what we hope is that we will have more calcium doping, is that maybe we have some systematics which will allow us to conclude something on the possibility that these ferroelectric fluctuations play a role in TC. Obviously, what would be great is to get a 1K TC, but at the moment, we could not find any sample with a TC higher than 0.3K. Okay, second thing I wanted to discuss with you is the breaking of inversion symmetry and spin orbit coupling. So spin orbit in the system has been found by looking or by measuring magnetoconductance. So what you see here is a change in conductance as a function of magnetic field for different dopings. So minus 300 volt, we are in the underdope regime, and when you go in this direction, you bring more and more carriers. And at the time, we compared this data to famous data from Bergman in the 80s, who has been studying magnetotransport in magnesium very thin layers. And what you see here is that if you measure a magnesium film by itself, you find this positive magnetoconductance very similar to what we get here, which is in fact a signature of weak localization. So quantum correction to the resistivity, to the conductivity, which is linked to interference of electrons around close paths. And when you put a magnetic field, which is perpendicular to the surface, you dephase the electron waves and you restore the conductivity. In his experiments, Bergman was adding on the surface of magnesium gold, which is a strong spin orbit scatterer. And what he found is that when he was putting this gold, he was seeing a dip first, and then an increase. And this is what you see here. Again, very similar to what we see when we add carriers. And this effect is called weak anti-localization, and it's telling you that you have spin orbit in the system. And you can analyze these curves very precisely, and from these curves, you can extract the strength of the spin orbit. And this is what you see here. This is the strength of the spin orbit as a function of the gate, and you see that it's taking off. And it's starting to increase in a doping region which is close to the one where we see superconductivity. The scale is quite large, 10 milliEV at max, much larger than the superconducting gap, which is 40 microEV. Now, one thing which is important is that in this system, the spin orbit is not an ionic or band spin orbit, but it's a Rochebaud-type spin orbit. It's a spin orbit which is linked to the breaking of inversion symmetry that you have at this interface. And in fact, you can prove this by studying the relation between the spin orbit scattering time and the elastic scattering time. If you have an ionic or band spin orbit, tau SO is proportional to the elastic scattering time, because the more scattering events you have, the more chances you have to lose your spin phase currents. But if it's a Rajbah type spin orbit, tau SO goes as tau minus 1. This is a Dyakonov parallel relation, and this is what you see here. So it's quite important, because it's telling us that the spin orbit is a signature of the interfacial nature of the system. Now, I'm talking about the spin orbit because, in principle, there should be some effect on superconductivity. The spin orbit is mixing the spin states, and in principle, you should have a trivial order parameter for superconductivity. So we have not yet junctions in Geneva, but what we notice is that if you look at the parallel critical field, you see that this parallel critical field as a function of gate is much higher than the paramagnetic limit or the Pauli limit, the field at which, in principle, you break the Cooper pairs. And one explanation is spin orbit, because when you mix the spin states, it's much harder to break the pairs. And from this increase, from the ratio between this parallel field and this value of the paramagnetic limit, you can go back to the spin orbit scattering time if you use this formula, which is coming from this paper of Clem, Beasley, and co-workers. Now, if you do this, you find, okay, I didn't introduce this graph, but you find a value which is here, and this is the spin orbit scattering time we extracted from transport. So we're quite convinced that there is a signature of spin orbit in superconductivity, but we have to do more to look at the symmetry of the order parameter. And finally, the last thing I wanted to discuss is tunneling results and the underdoped regime. I showed you this phase diagram before, and when we measured this in the beginning, we realized quickly that if you were fitting, if you fit TC close to the quantum critical point, you find that TC goes as V minus this critical voltage to a power 2/3. And 2/3 is the exponent product you expect for 2 plus 1 quantum XY model, so a phase model. And when we saw this, we wondered if it was telling us that what was controlling the establishment of zero resistance was the locking of the phase and not the development of the amplitude of the order parameter. So in other words, this line would be controlled by phase fluctuations. More recently, we were measuring another set of samples, and we realize again that if you look at transitions on this side of the phase diagram, you see a very rounded transition. If you're on this side, it's a very sharp transition. In 2013, Johann Mannhardt in Stuttgart, in this paper of Richter and co-workers, they could measure tunneling. So they did tunnels through lanthanum aluminate. You see these gold electrodes. And you see here the conductance versus bias. And you see this superconducting conductance curve. And they could follow this tunneling versus gate. So you go here in the underdoped regime. And they find something quite surprising. This is the TC, this is our TC dome. This jump here is linked to the criterion used for the TC definition, but this is our dome. Now, if you start from the overdoped regime, you see the gap, and you see that when you reduce the carrier density, the gap is increasing and TC is increasing. Everything is fine. But when you move here, you continue, you see that TC is going down, but the gap continues to go up, which is somehow suggesting that you have pairing without phase currents. So this is some kind of a scenario, like maybe a Costelli-Stauless scenario, where you would have your 2D superconductor and some mean field transition, which would do something like this. And this is something to analyze, but it's a very large distance between the T mean field and TKT. And another thing which is very unclear is why we know that this point is somehow related to the presence of these heavy bands. Now, why would it be like this? This is very unclear. I should say that these data have been discussed by Greeley and co-workers in a model where they think or they assume some patchwork of superconducting and non-superconducting regions. But there is something which is a bit strange, is that if you look at the data, you realize that to explain the data, you need to have a distribution of TC. And what you see that when you are in the overdope regime, you have a TC distribution which is somewhere here. But when you move to the underdope regime, where you lose superconductivity, you need to have higher, first a broader distribution and higher TC. And so this is also a bit surprising. So I think we do not understand this underdope regime, and we need really much more experiments in this region of the phase diagram, and we're working on it. Okay, so let me end by mentioning a few recent results or exciting developments. I will not be able to mention all the things which have been done recently. I wanted to mention that we have for some time now high mobility samples. In Geneva, to get these high mobility samples, we lower the gross temperature, but there are other techniques which have been used, like capping layers, which allow mobilities up to 8,000 and maybe much more these days. And you're entering in the quantum regime. And this is telling you that when you measure now the sheet resistance versus magnetic field, you start to see oscillations. You see Shubnikov de Haas oscillations. You see your results from Stanford, results from Geneva, where you see a change in temperature. And if you know Shubnikov de Haas oscillations and you see these curves, you see, okay, there are different frequencies which appear, which is probably telling us that we have several bands or subbands which are contributing. But in fact, if you analyze the data, at least this data on the left, we came to the conclusion that in fact, it's a single band which is oscillating, but you have to take into account spin orbit in the system and the Zeeman effect, which is important for the system. We are able these days to realize bi-interfaces. Growing, you see on lanthanum aluminate another strontium titanate layer and a lanthanum aluminate layer. And to have two superconducting systems. And the idea behind this work, we're still working on it. I should admit that we do not understand all the results. The idea was that we should be able to couple these two superconducting systems and maybe to say something about fluctuations, because these fluctuations should be reduced if the system is more three-dimensional. So these layers we know are superconducting, but we're still studying this. Very exciting developments are in the area of nanostructures. It's possible to write nanoscale and electronic circuits using a technique which has been developed in the group of Jeremy Levy in Pittsburgh. And the idea looks very simple. We start with a lanthanum aluminate layer, which is 3 unit cells thick. You may remember that you need at least 4 unit cells to get conductivity. So you start with 3 unit cells. The system is insulating, and you use an atomic force microscope equipped with a conducting tip. You start from a contact, and you apply a bias, and you move your tip over the surface. And what happens is that additional bias that you apply is inducing conduction just under the tip over a width which can be as small as 10 nanometers. So you see an experiment here, which has been realized in Geneva. So you start here with your AFM tip. In green, you see the current, no current. It's one contact, another contact. You draw your line, and it's only when you're touching the second contact that you suddenly see a current passing. So you've created a nano channel, which can be characterized. Now, this technique and these channels are stable for some time. So it doesn't stay for a very long time. You have to be a bit careful, but if you cool these devices, you can measure them for a long time. And in the group of Jeremy Levy, they did a lot. They realized nano transistors. You see here the dimensions, 2 nanometer, a side gate, which has also been written. So they could demonstrate this transistor-like operation. They could measure quantum dot at low temperature. They even have signatures, as you see here, of possible electron pairing without superconductivity, so without phase coherence. In some of these very nice experiments. thermal power has been measured in this system and with giant Seebeck coefficient and giant oscillations that you see here. This is done by colleagues in Genoa, in Italy. And these oscillations could be the signature of localized states at the bottom of the conduction band. Maybe it's a signature of the missing electron in the system. I would like also to mention very nice recent experiments in the group of Manuel Bibes, Agnès Barthélemy, and also by Michel Viret at CEA on the inverse Reichbach-Edelstein effect. It's another way to probe the spin orbit in the system. So you use a ferromagnetic resonance to inject a spin current at the interface. And because of the strong spin orbit in the system, this injection is shifting the Fermi surface, is producing a DC current that you can measure. So it's a very nice way to probe spin orbit. And you see here, okay, without detail, you can see here how spin orbit is taking off. This is, again, the gate voltage. And this allows probing spin orbit in a regime where we cannot probe it using magnetotransport because we are not anymore in a regime where spin orbit is a weak perturbation. Let me also mention this very nice work of coming from Naples, where they introduce a one-unit cell of europium titanate at the interface. Europium titanate is an antiferromagnet in bulk at low temperature, a few Kelvin, but in thin film is ferromagnetic, it seems here. And again, as a function of the gate, they could switch from a Kondo-like state to a ferromagnetic electron system here with the gate. And again, the switching is linked to, according to the studies in Naples, to the presence of these heavy bands. Okay, and finally, something which is maybe a bit more provocative. One question is this system a very good platform for Majorana fermions? If you look at some of the proposals for Majorana fermions, you need a semiconductor nanowire with a strong spin orbit, proximity coupled to a superconductor and a magnetic field. And if you think about it, our system has superconductivity, has spin orbit. Both are tunable by electric field. We can use this europium titanate to create a Zeeman field, and we're able to make nanowires. So there is really a question, can we go in this direction and try to design an experiment which would allow us to probe the presence of Majorana fermions? Very interesting path. And finally, let me mention that there are other systems. I would like to mention here the lanthanum titanate, strontium titanate system, and the beautiful work in the group of Jérôme Lesueur, who is here. So lanthanum titanate is not a band insulator. It's a MOT insulator. But there has been a lot of work in this system. And you see here the phase diagram, again, with a superconducting state. And many, many experiments have been done also in this system. I would like also to mention the work of Susan Stemmer in Stanford with gadolinium titanate, another MOT insulator, with, again, interesting results, but I have no time to discuss this in detail. Okay, so finally, let me maybe go back to the question that I raised in the beginning of of this presentation. So are we going to a new oxide electronics? And I'm showing here with all the modesty which is necessary the 1947 Bell Lab transistor and a superconducting transistor in Geneva in 2009. But I'm showing this because only in a few years, 2009, 2014, you see here a million transistors which have been realized in Stuttgart in the group of Johann Mannhardt. And you see here a room temperature textbook characteristics of a transistor. So are we going to this oxide electronics? Will we have in a few years 250 billion of billion of oxide transistor per year? I'm not sure. But I think what these experiments show, they show that standard technology allows the realization of functional devices with oxides. And what I really hope is that this variety of properties and functionalities that we find in oxide will soon find its way in some applications. And with this, I will stop, and I will just mention here a few reviews which are discussing this oxide interface physics. Thank you very much.